Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing, my chance to talk with artists, policymakers, and performers to hear their stories, what inspires their creations, what decisions change their careers, what relationships influenced their work. I began listening to classical music in my 20s. Job hunting as an actor in L.A. meant you'd be in your car 3-4 hours a day. I'd drive around listening to the local classical stations, sometimes pulling over to call from my car phone to find out the name of the piece, who composed it, who performed it, and who conducted. While I was learning the difference between Mahler and Mendelssohn, my guest today, Esa-Pekka Salonen, a Finnish French horn player also in his 20s, was making his conducting debut with the Philharmonia Orchestra in London. Today, Salonen is their principal conductor and the new composer in residence at the New York Philharmonic for the next 3 years.
And that's new because I mean, obviously I've been composing for decades and since I started studying music really, but this is the first time I have an official position as a composer as opposed to being a conductor of some orchestra. And that, for me, this is really fascinating. Exciting.
For a lot of people, it's fascinating, actually. Was composition something that was the goal originally, and conducting was accidental, I'm told, correct?
That's true, yeah. I started studying composition quite early in my teens. We started a group of young composers in Finland. I was born and raised in Helsinki, Finland. We had a group of young composers. Magnus Lindberg was one of them. He was actually the first composer in residence with the New York Philharmonic. Kaija Saariaho, another very well-known composer now. So we started this group together, sort of idealistic group of young Turks kind of trying to change the world. And, you know, we thought that new music is good for people and therefore we took it out to, you know, gas stations, prisons, old people's homes and so on. And it was one of those missions. And it turned out that the real conductors at the time in Finland were not interested in our stuff. So we felt that one of us has to conduct something, has to be able to do it. So I was kind of voted to become the conductor of the group because I had a lot of performance experience. I was a horn player, French horn player, and I used to sub in Helsinki orchestras, in the opera orchestra, radio orchestra and so on. So I knew what it meant to be on stage and play and so on. So I started studying conducting just for this purpose, basically. So it was a fluke. And then I realized that I actually enjoyed it quite a bit and it seemed to be coming naturally to me and so on.
What did you enjoy about it?
The people. Now when I think about it, I wasn't so clear about that before. But now when I have long periods of composing only, which is very lonely, of course, you know, you're alone. Essentially, it's very slow. You know, you imagine something, and then you kind of translate that dream into a sort of notation and so on. It's a very slow process and lonely, as I said. And the energy is a different kind of energy. It's the sort of marathon runner's energy, you know, the long haul. You have to kind of pace yourself and you have to be very, very patient and so on. Whereas conducting, of course, it's a very intense thing socially. I mean, you are on stage with 100 other people, and in the rehearsals, you are trying to focus them. You are trying to present your ideas about the piece in such a way that they not only accept them, but they would willingly follow you to wherever you want to go, and so on. And I really enjoy that aspect of it. The actual act of conducting, you know, standing there on the box, waving this stick in the air, is not very interesting, in my opinion. It's just like the tip of the iceberg. But
and why is that person there? For those who don't understand that history of classical music, there wasn't always someone standing on a podium conducting, correct?
That's right. Yeah, in the old days, I mean, the very old days, we are talking about Bach and Haydn and Mozart and so on. The music was simple enough, and it behaved in a sort of predictable enough way that the musicians could actually take care of it themselves without somebody giving the beat and, you know, giving instructions as to where it goes and so on. But then it started to become a little more complex with Beethoven. And, you know, Beethoven symphonies are already very difficult to perform without a conductor, unless you are okay with a totally standard, middle-of-the-road kind of approach. But if you want to do something with the music, then there has to be somebody behind a concept. And then, of course, you know, we move on in history onto the big opera guys, Verdi, Wagner, so on, and then, you know, onto Strauss, Bruckner, Mahler, you know, Stravinsky. That music cannot be played successfully.
It's impossible.
Yeah, it's impossible from the coordination point of view, but also the way it's composed, because the composer assumes that the interpretation has some kind of flexibility and ideas about the tempo and the pacing and so on. Wagner, for instance, is all about the pacing. So what the conductor does is to handle the flow of time over an arch of, I don't know, 5 hours, 6 hours, so on, including the breaks, of course. So it's a profession that became necessary. And somehow, somewhere during this process, the conductor also became more visible, more of the center of the musical life, the musical process, the musical culture than the composer had been. And of course, if you think of the modern recording industry, you know, with the LP and especially the CD and now the DVDs and what have you, the performer seems to be the center of almost all attention. And the person who wrote the music, who in my opinion is rather a big part of the chain, is actually not, well, recognized, yeah, but not treated in the same sort of heroic way as the conductors are, for instance. I had a really kind of illuminating experience in LA some years ago. I was at Starbucks actually, queuing for my coffee, and there was a guy in front of me who asked whether I was so-and-so, and I said, yes, I am. And he introduced himself, and he said he was also a composer. And I said, okay, sorry, I don't recognize your name. I'm sorry about that. And he said, no, nobody does. But I write songs for pop stars. And he said, I told me that he had written a couple of songs for Madonna and you know, these huge names. And his name doesn't appear anywhere. And I thought, you know, this is symptomatic. So it's not only a classical music problem. I mean, it's a problem across the board. There was some guy in London, composer, who calculated that if a composer wants to get up to the minimum wage, annual minimum wage of the UK, he or she needs like 1.7 trillion downloads per year or hits per year.
What I want to get back to is you are in London and you're at the Philharmonia, correct?
Yes.
And you're playing the French horn.
And not anymore.
Not anymore.
I used to, no.
What were you playing at the moment you were asked to step up and conduct? Isn't that when you were first asked to conduct at the Philharmonia?
Yes, I was still playing the horn, yeah.
You're playing the horn. Yeah. And who was the conductor at the time?
Michael Tilson Thomas.
Tilson Thomas was conducting the Philharmonia then.
Yes, he was supposed to do Mahler's Third Symphony.
And what happened?
I think he injured his elbow, like a tennis elbow, something like that, and had to pull out. And they called everybody on the planet with no success, obviously, and then they ended up with me. Who was completely unknown. I had an agent who worked with a few artists, but his main business was in golf accessory, and he operated out of a golf course in a smallish city of in Finland where nobody spoke English and so on and so forth. So it took a little while for the messages to get through. I had had a long night with my pals, composer pals, when the call came in early in the morning. So it's this guy from the golf course saying that the Philharmonia wants you to conduct Mahler 3. And I told him to disappear in using expressions I will not repeat here.
Yes, not on public radio.
Yes, absolutely. And he called back a couple hours later when I was already talkable and said, okay, here's the deal. So do you want to do it? And I thought, okay. So if it goes well, fine. If it doesn't, at least I can tell this to my grandchildren. That I've done it once, or at least tried to. And then I went and did it, and that's how I became a full-time conductor for a while.
Your parents were not musicians, correct?
No. My father was a businessman, and my mom was mostly home. They loved music, listened to music. They went to concerts occasionally, but they didn't practice music
but they listened to recorded music.
Yes, my father especially, he loved opera and he loved Italian opera. So I had a lot of Verdi and Puccini playing when I was growing up.
And how did that affect you?
I have had a very problematic relationship with Italian opera ever since. This is quite normal, I guess. You know, when your dad is really into something, and then you grow up, you kind of decide not to be into the same thing. I think it's a healthy reaction.
So that's not just a Finnish thing. It's a...
No, I think it's
a universal thing.
It's a global thing. And once he came home, he was very proud. He had bought a new recording of La Bohème. And he said it. He told me that he got it really cheaply. It was a special offer. And it was a Deutsche Oper Berlin version of the La Bohème in German. And I grew up with this recording. And it's funny because... when I hear it now in Italian, it sounds all wrong. I can't listen to it in Italian because it goes in German in my memory. And it's funny how we get conditioned in our childhood and it never changes.
When you stepped up at the age of 25 to conduct the Mahler Third with the Philharmonia, did you have a sense, like, what did you do? That you think, how did it go? What do you attribute to that it was so successful? Because everything I read, they talk about you becoming an overnight sensation as a conductor as a result of this performance. While you were doing it, were you saying to yourself, wow, this is really going well? Or you don't think about that?
I think the critical moment is the first minute in the first rehearsal with the orchestra. I mean, most of my colleagues can actually say the same thing, I'm sure. That when you meet a new orchestra, especially when you're young, and you don't have that routine, how to deal with people you don't know, that's the moment when you don't know how it's going to go. And with the Philharmonia, I felt this connection in a really strange way. And it's very hard to explain. It's something that happens between people. I mean, even in your private life, and you meet somebody and you know from day one, or the first second actually, that this person is going to be a very important influence, positive, constructive influence in my life. And the opposite happens as well. all the flags go up, and you know that you have to stay away from this person, no matter what.
And you're very instinctual that way.
Well, we all are. I think it's a biological thing, you know, that, you know, it has to do with survival and, you know, the forming internal relations with the tribe and, you know, keeping the cohesion of the society and this and that. But so with the Philharmonia, I felt straight away that, wow, these guys seem to not only accept me, but they seem to follow me and kind of willingly. And that was quite an experience because it was the famous Philharmonia Orchestra and the conductor was Riccardo Muti at the time. And you know, it's like a big deal. And I have had these kinds of experiences later on in life as well. And it never fails, the mechanism. I felt the same kind of thing in L.A. a year after the Philharmonia concert when I met them for the first time. And I had no idea what to expect. It was my first trip to the U.S. ever, so it was a culture shock. And of course, I start out in L.A., which is like even more of a shock than anything else would have been. And then
I can say that again.
Yeah, and then I step in front of the band, and they are terribly nice, but more than that, you know, like connecting straight away. And that for me is the very essential thing about making music. And with both orchestras, LA and the Philharmonia, I've sometimes had these very strange experiences, you know, some kind of communication that is beyond, certainly beyond words, but also beyond gestures in a way. And I'm thinking of something, I can swear that they do it before I've done it. So that there's this kind of fine-tuned trust in each other, in a way. And it has to be mutual, otherwise it doesn't work.
So after the performance of the Mahler in London, you were 26 years old. When does your first assignment come as a music director of a ensemble?
I started out in Stockholm with the Swedish Radio Orchestra soon after this.
Was it a job you wanted?
It was the best orchestra in Scandinavia at the time and still is one of the very best, if not the best. And that was perfect for me because I was in a culture that was familiar to me. I spoke the language and still it was away from home.
Was staying in the Scandinavian sphere
a
goal? Did you want to stay there for the time being?
It felt like a very good idea because I liked the idea of being in a culture where no particular translation was necessary and I understood the reactions of people and they understood reactions of mine or the lack of reactions. And it was a very good orchestra and they were terribly nice people And the same kind of thing, that there was a very sort of intuitive understanding.
People have a prejudice, I suppose, myself included, that there's a Scandinavian soul and that they crave music of a certain type or key. Or did they want, is that not true? Do they want to hear everything?
I'm not sure there's a Scandinavian soul. It's a myth in many ways. Technically, if we look out from the Finnish perspective and try to decide who are the ones that are closest to us in, you know, historically, traditionally, temperamentally, in every way. It's the Swedes. And also Finland was part of Sweden for 600 years. So there's a lot of history. But still there's a fundamental difference in how we behave in social life. And the Swedes are very smooth, socially smooth, skillful people. They work very well in groups. They're very successful in everything they do. You know, they are experts at selling their products globally and internationally and so on. And they are very brilliant in many ways. Finns don't speak much. I mean, talking, using more than the absolute minimum amount of words to get your message across is somehow considered being frivolous or, you know, suspect or something like that. And
gregarious.
Yeah, some kind of, you know, trying to achieve your goal through flattery or whatever. And, I realized this. I saw this very clearly when after some years in LA, I went back to my country house in Finland and went out jogging. And I had learned this habit of greeting everybody, like you do in LA. You know, you're walking on the street and you just greet people. And I was greeting everyone, every villager. And they looked at me like some kind of space aliens. What has happened to this guy? He was perfectly normal a few years ago. Now he's been in America and now he's like this. Right. So what's
he's neurotic.
What is this all about?
Salonen is rooted in the United States. Two of his three children were born here. And I'd love to claim Salonen as our very own, but I'd have to get in line. He's an international superstar with 7 honorary doctorates from 4 different countries. Be sure to explore the Here's the Thing archives. You can find my conversation with Alex and Jamie Bernstein, whose father, like Salonen, had a serendipitous debut as a conductor at a major concert hall.
So he gets back to Carnegie Hall at, 5 in the morning and passes out. And then, like an hour and a half later, the phone rings, and it's Bruno Zerato of the New York Philharmonic saying, "This is it, kid. You have to go on this afternoon." And it was on the radio. It was a national broadcast.
Take a listen at heresthething.org.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. In 2003, the Walt Disney Concert Hall, home to the LA Philharmonic, opened in downtown Los Angeles. The space is internationally beloved for its design and its acoustics. Esa-Pekka Salonen, the music director of the orchestra at that time, christened the space when it opened.
The project got started in the late 80s already. So I was involved. I was a music director designate from 89. So I started talking with Frank Gehry already then. But they had started the fundraising, and the first donation came in 87 already, I believe. So it really was a 15-year project. And then we started developing the idea, and it came to a halt a couple of times.
For financial reasons.
Financial and political.
And Geary's conception.
It was not so much about that, but it was just things that happened, like the riots in 92 in L.A. And, you know, somehow...
Rodney King.
Yeah, when you realize that the society was kind of falling apart and everybody realized that there were these huge tensions and that the kind of peace and rule of law was just a very sort of thin layer on top of it all. So I think everybody felt that there are huge problems that need to be addressed. And at that point, to even speak about building a new concert hall in downtown L.A. felt like the wrong thing to do. Right. And I think it...
A new police station, maybe, but not
rather some, you know, more constructive ideas as to how to alleviate the situation, how to make things better and so on. But then things moved on, luckily, later in the 90s. And I think the turning point was in 1996 when the Philharmonic did a month-long residence in Paris. And lots of people came to hear their own orchestra playing in a great concert hall in Paris, the Châtelet. And then I think that was the thing that changed the whole thing, that all of a sudden people realized that a musical experience is really a sum of its parts. One very important thing is the space where the orchestra plays. And if it doesn't sound good, there's little hope.
What was it like to live so many years in Los Angeles, coming from where you came from, and just culturally?
I loved it. I think it's a really great place to live, and it takes a little while to get used to it,
yeah.
To be honest. I mean, it's a lousy place to visit, because in 2 weeks, you're only confused, and you don't get it. But it really does grow on you, and also for me as an artist and as a person, it was really incredibly helpful to be away from the sort of European canon, you know, the sort of arrogant European intellectual canon that, you know,
in the music world.
And of course, when I started out in LA, I had this some kind of residue from this European thing that, okay, I'm here to bring some kind of culture to
this elevate spot. You.
This culture as medicine kind of thing, which is vile.
Thank God I'm here.
Yes, aren't you lucky? And it was an interesting process because I was talking about things, you know, the way we used to in Europe those days, and, you know, with this kind of all kinds of intellectual constructs and, you know, the historic necessity of atonal music and this and that. And people were very nice. They said, oh, yeah, great, interesting. But how does it sound? Or asking these questions that are the obvious questions that everybody should ask, but we weren't for some reason asking. So what that sounds great, but what does it do to me? How will I feel? What is the actual effect and impact of what you're doing on me? And I couldn't quite answer to those questions. And this started a big process where I kind of rethought my values and my life and my artistic output.
While you were in Los Angeles?
Yeah, while I was there.
Can you describe that process?
It's hard to describe it in words, but what happened composition-wise was that I had come to a drought. For a few years, I hadn't written anything. And I was blaming the conducting schedule. I was conducting around the world, and I was learning all that repertoire. You know, all of a sudden, I was doing all the Beethoven symphonies and the Brahms and the Bruckner and God knows what. So I spent lots of hours in front of the score, buried. But it was not only about the lack of time. It was more like a crisis. I didn't know what to write and how to write. And I had this, like a dichotomy, that the music I loved playing and performing was not like the music I wrote. I loved playing the big, lush stuff by, you know, Richard Strauss and Mahler and Bruckner and Stravinsky and Sibelius and all that. I loved that resonant sound of a symphony orchestra and the fact that when 100 people play full throttle, it's more thrilling than almost anything else in the world to witness that energy coming at you.
It's more thrilling than anything in the world. Not almost anything else. Anything.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you.
I'm with you on that.
Thank you. And the music I was writing at the time was not like that. It was because I was still in the sort of European modernist kind of box, straitjacket rather, where so many things were forbidden. And it sounds utterly ridiculous. I'm here telling you what was forbidden, because there was no particular body that was doing the forbidding, but it was just like, it was considered to be wrong to write a melody. It was considered to be wrong to use pulse. It was considered to be absolutely wrong to do something that sounds like a modulation, i.e. moving from one key to another.
And you didn't have anything like that?
No. So finally, I get to a point in L.A. with the sort of newly found freedom. I think that's the thing about Southern California, the freedom, the sort of openness of the culture, the curiosity, you know. Many colleagues I've been talking to, composers and other artists, people like Peter Sellers and Bill Viola, John Adams, they all say the same thing, that coming to Southern California, or California rather, was essential for them to become the artist they wanted to be or had the potential to be.
When the time comes to create the schedule for a given season, what factors go into that beyond availability of artists or whatever? Is it all you? Do you sit down and people just take dictation? You say, I want to play this and this and this and this, or are there board influences?
It's a very complex process, actually, because I think it would be irresponsible for the music director to dictate every program according to his or her tastes. Because at the end of the day, this is a public institution. We are serving the public, and a symphony orchestra has to be and is a constructive force in the community, and therefore it has to cater to more than one taste, and it has to find the balance between leading and satisfying the needs. But also you kind of gauge the reactions after every concert, and you know, I did. In my years in LA, I did about 1,000 concerts with them. So I learned to read the reaction quite well, I think. And I think that towards the end, especially the audience was quite proud of the fact that they are the cool audience. You know, they can take all this stuff. You know, they are comfortable with new music. They are comfortable with less known works. But also they love their Tchaikovsky, they love their, you know, Verdi Requiem, and there's nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with that.
When seats open up inside the ensemble itself, describe that process of how those seats are filled. Is it a committee, typically, of the orchestra itself? Well, do you have an input into that?
Every orchestra has a slightly different process.
What was it like in Los Angeles?
But First of all, they announced the opening in publications, you know, the musical publications and on the internet and so on, and they get applications. And these days, a major U.S. orchestra gets at least 150 applications for one position. If the positions are like principal player or something like that, they might get 300 or 500, insane numbers in any case. Perhaps. So there's an auditions committee that listens to the candidates. Some orchestras screen them based on the CVs and just invite a smaller number of people to play. Some orchestras listen to everybody. But in any event, the committee, elected committee, sits there and listens to everybody who play behind the screen, so there are no extra musical issues at play. And then for the final round, usually the music director joins them for the final round. They then vote and recommend a number of players, mostly like five or six, for the music director to choose from.
And the music director does indeed choose.
Yes, but you know, this is also something where I think it makes a lot of sense to trust the instincts of the players, the colleagues, because they are the ones who actually sit next to this.
But
one.
If they hand you this five finalists, how do you know which one they favor?
Well, it's
they've told you.
There's a discussion. There's a discussion, and then quite often I used to invite a couple of people to play with the orchestra for X number of weeks to see how they fit in.
Sure.
And sometimes, you know, people are too individual or people are just not tuned into collaborating and so on. So, and this, there's no way to discover this until you've seen it.
During the time you were in Los Angeles, how, if at all, was there any frequency in which people tried to co-opt you, especially with your success as a composer, into creating film score?
I had a couple of discussions with a couple of people, directors, but it never materialized. And I know...
Were you open to the idea?
Yes, yes. I find it fascinating, especially when I hear a great film score by a great film composer. It really is... it's an art form. It really is an art form. But then when I talk to my friends in the film business and they tell me about the schedules, you know, like I think James Newton Howard took over the King Kong project 4 weeks before the film was supposed to be finished, and he wrote more than 2 hours of music in 3.5 weeks. And I said, well, did you sleep? He said, no.
Yeah. It's not ideal.
And that's a skill. I mean, to be able to do that and deliver like highest quality film music, it's a skill, and I'm not sure I have it.
Many conductors, many people in the classical repertoire, some of them a bit older now, have tried their hand to varying degrees as composers and had some success. Some pieces they've done are performed and are admired. Why do you think some of your colleagues don't get the traction with their work that you have had?
Well, lots of reasons, I believe. First of all, our era is that of specialists. You know, everything is getting more and more specific. Everyone gets a smaller and smaller segment of the full process. And if somebody's trying to do more than one thing, that is immediately suspicious somehow. You know, if you think of, say, chocolate. When I was a kid, I went to a supermarket and bought a chocolate bar. Now, I would go to a specialist chocolatier.
A chocolatier.
And I would choose between beans from Guatemala or beans from
Ghana. And the jalapeno chocolate.
And there would be like 64% beans as opposed to sugar or whatever. And everything is just becoming more and more specific.
Yes.
So I think the same process happens in culture as well. The idea of covering a bigger segment of the entire process is not popular for some reason. I don't know why. This happens with builders, you know, like people in construction work. You know, people specialize in smaller and smaller parts of the building process. And then you have to have like 8 specialists to do your house instead of having 1 or 2 guys in the past who would do everything. And I think it has to do with that. The other thing is more sort of mundane. I think it, you know, in order to be a composer, you have to compose, i.e. you have to set aside the time. And in my case, I made the decision that I conduct only 6 months a year or less, and the rest is for composing.
It's something you worked at.
This needs planning, you know, and of course...
inspiration.
And you have to have management, you have to have people who support you in this. And of course, you know, to be totally...
Do you need isolation?
Yeah, you need to be in one place. And also, you know, conducting is more lucrative from, certainly from the financial point of view, but also, you know, you get this service, you fly first class and you stay in nice hotels.
You're a star.
You're a star, and people clap when you come in. I mean...
They clap when you come in.
Well, by definition, they clap. And mostly they clap after the show also. So it's okay. Composer is just sitting there, you know, long days and quite often nothing happens.
It's a different life.
Yeah, it's a different life. I had an experience many years ago. I was in Paris, invited to... The French radio did a festival of... young European composers' work, and they played a piece of mine, and I went to hear the concert. I couldn't go to the rehearsals, and they had booked a perfectly fine little hotel close to the radio, French radio, and I'm checking in with my wife, and I get really sort of annoyed. I said, look at this piece of, you know what, how can they expect anybody to stay in a place like this? And she looks at me and says, shut up. You are here as a composer. This is composer's life. You are not here as a conductor. So just suck it up.
Was there a piece you wrote that came out of you more spontaneously, one that just came flowing out of you?
It's always different. It's always different. It's just slow. This is my experience. And you cannot make it go faster. It just takes the time it needs. And then sometimes a piece comes out pretty much as it should. And it sounds as it should in the first rehearsal, and then I change maybe a couple little dynamics or something, but that's it. And then with some other pieces, they are not born right somehow. And I take them back and fix and modify and change things and then play it again. Still not good. And then in some cases, this process has gone on for a couple of years. In some cases, I've been able to fix it and, you know, get to a result that I wanted to have in the first place. And in some cases, I just gave up. I thought, okay, this is it. Warts and all, you know, this is the way it came out, and I'll try again.
Do you yourself ever get overwhelmed by a piece when you're performing it even now? Do you yourself even find... I mean, I've had other conductors say to me, I tried my best to leave the tears for the audience. But do you find sometimes even you get crushed by the music you're playing?
It does happen. It does happen.
Give me an example, if you will.
There are two kinds of occasions, I think. There's, you know, the expectation reward cycle where, you know, there are some spots in some works that I find so unbelievable that when I'm conducting, I'm not hurrying exactly, but I can't wait to get to that spot. And it does it every time. Well, some modulations, for instance, you know, like in Bruckner 7 in a slow movement, when the big culmination of the adagio where the whole orchestra like falls onto a C major chord and it's just overwhelming. And it's an experience which is physical and emotional and everything. It's almost sexual because it's
spiritual.
Like, yeah, it's everything. And it's very hard not to be very, very moved by this. And it's funny because I've conducted this piece, I don't know, 30, 40 times and over the years, and still it does it every time. But then there's a different category, which is more like, it doesn't have to do with the actual piece so much, but it's more like the, let's call it flow. It's those moments, and this is not, doesn't happen every day or every week even, but sometimes I experience this kind of flow state where I feel that I'm one with not only the piece, but also with the orchestra, and somehow, in some way, with the audience also, that we create this kind of ocean or a river, and I'm just like riding on a wave, and I'm... This sounds terribly New Age, but it I can't really describe it very well. I'm receiving and not giving. And I'm riding on something which is much, much, much more powerful than myself. And those are incredible moments. And, sure. But I cannot call them. You know, there's no way to guarantee that this happens. When it happens, there's nothing like it.
Esa Pekka Salonen, the rare combination of conductor and composer. He said recently that he's finally got the balance right, a 50-50 split. To see Salonen at work, check out the orchestra app he created for the iPad. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.